I mean, once I started,
can't control yourself.
I can't control. There's no once you start, there's no go. Once you're in, there's no escape. Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the 99%.
You're Lucien Waugh Daly.
And you're Michael McAndrew.
The 99% is a weekly podcast about the things that affect society today.
Around the world, across the internet, we're here to discuss culture, technology, politics, and more.
Yes.
Okay. Welcome, everybody. It's a very exciting week here at the 99%. We've got another great episode lined up for you, don't we, Michael?
We do, yes. We have a lot to talk about. We have a fantastic interview, which we're going to start the show off with.
Yeah. And who's this interview with, Michael?
It's with a guy called Felix...
Felix Duguivre.
Duguivre. You see, you're the guy with the who does French. I don't do any French, so you're kind of
French,
the...
Yes.
Yeah, you're the expert on pronouncing... French
name. I probably just mangled his name, but yeah, anyway, my best attempt.
Yeah, Felix Duguivre. So he is the lead actor in the up and coming Eden, which is a French film produced by.
It's directed by Mia Hansen-Løve.
Yeah.
And written by she and her brother, Sven Hansen-Løve, who we interviewed on the show last week.
Right.
And it's released in the UK and Ireland today, July 24th.
Today. Yeah, exactly.
It's a very interesting film. And we were delighted to be able to talk about Sven and Felix. And Felix has a lot of really interesting things to say about the film and about film and music in general. And... shall we play the interview?
I think we shall.
This is a really interesting project. How did you originally get involved in Eden? Were you offered the role or did you audition? I know you worked with Olivier Assayas before us.
Yeah, it's through Olivier Assayas. Antoinette Boulard, who is the casting director of Olivier, worked on Eden. And so I was not living in Paris at the time. I was living in I was doing a exchange program in Los Angeles. And so, Antoinette wrote me an email and said, "Oh, would you be interested in auditioning for this project?" And she said, "It's about garage music." And I was like, "Oh, a project about rock garage?" I said, "Why not?" And then I arrived in Paris and I understood it was about electronic music. And I'm personally a big fan of electronic music, so I did the audition. And then Mia called me and said, "It's you. They're going to be cool."
Cool.
And that's it.
Yeah. So prior to the getting the role for the movie, what was your personal experience of the dance music scene?
What was my experience of the dance music scene?
Yeah. What was your?
I had organized a few parties in Paris with my friends, very close friends. We had organized 5 of them.
Cool.
So in a way, I was related to it, but I was not that much a specialist of the 90s, of the because in a way the 90s is a bit of a black hole for me. It's so much people know the same fact, which is Daft Punk and all the things that emerged from it, but the real rave scene was not really documented because there was no internet at the time, and in the same way, traditional media didn't really care when it exploded at first about it. So the project was for me really interesting on that aspect because it enabled me to dig into that.
When you were working on the film, did you get a sense in a broader way of how the dance music culture in the 1990s that Sven was involved in, how it had affected sort of your understanding of music and when you were growing up?
Yeah, completely. I think it's the shadow of this generation is huge on my generation because they were the first people, at least in French, because in America it was different, in Germany maybe it was also another issue, in England it was something else. They were the first people to believe in electronic music, and to create and produce. And so as every art, let's call it an art, in every art, the pioneers are the ones who are setting the rules, you know.
Mm.
So they set rules that are very, very important, not only in terms of the production, but also for DJs, like, just for instance, if you take Daft Punk, just the Daft Punk, the way they produce their first albums in home studios, it's influenced a whole generation, including mine, of producers who produce on their computers.
Right.
Just that is huge.
So, Felix, you've made two feature films now. How could you compare your experiences collaborating with both Olivier Zayas and Mia Hansen-Lowe?
On Olivier Zayas' film, I had a very smaller role. Mm-hmm. Like, very much smaller. In Eden, I was, we shot 54 days and I was there 53 days. So it's
wow.
Not the same collaboration, but... Yeah. But they are very, in a way, their cinema talks to each other. I mean, it's a sort of dialogue. Their film is a dialogue between each other, but they are very different on set. Olivier doesn't really talk to his actor, and does not that much takes, while Mia is very talkative. She knows exactly what she wants, and she talks a lot. So in that regard, it's very different.
Right. Did you meet or discuss with Sven much about specific character traits, since your character is largely a version of him?
Naturally, yes, in a way, because we talked a lot about souvenirs, about things that are not in the script, or I talked to his friends, or he gave me footage, pictures, music, he gave me the comic book, which is in the film, he gave me all these different things, and so... Without really setting a date and a meeting to talk about him, you know, and talking about him for 2 hours and me taking notes, it was a sort of a permanent discussion. But from the very beginning, we felt Paul was a character, and so it was never a matter of doing a replica of Sven, you know.
Mm. When we spoke to Sven earlier, he told us that, you know, he believes that Eden is a love story, really, between Paul, the character, and the music that he loves so much. How are you involved in approaching the character from that angle?
It's very funny that he says, the first time I read the script, which was two films, it was a longer script, I felt it was a... A guy who couldn't deal with his life because his first love story was a story with music and not with a girl. And there is a it's funny because you could read it also in a way that he doesn't build his sentimental life, you know. But in working on the film, I realized that I worked much more on the music than on a dramatic. I don't know how to say it on a dramatic. It was not a dramatic character in a way that I would think about how he builds his love story and stuff. It's really about him. It was really about getting to build a character who melts into music. I don't know if it's very clear, but it was. The more we were getting to the film, the more we were getting to filming. Also, the more it was about the music. Like it would. There's a scene that I read in the script, and I thought it would be shot that way. And then when we arrived on the shooting, it looked like a choreography around the music. And then the lyrics, the more we would get in the film and I would hear the lyrics, the more the lyrics would make sense about the story. It was always about music.
Yeah, now the film's dialogue alternates between English and French. Felix, you have a really excellent English accent. How was your experience of working this way?
In English?
Yeah, like alternating between English and French.
As I told you, I was coming back from Los Angeles, so I had been talking English for a long time, and my parents talked to me in English as much as in French, because they lived in Australia for a long time. So I've always, English was always not that much an issue, although I'm trying to work on my accent in order to have a better one. Hmm. But, so it was, and also I felt more comfortable playing in English than in French, which is strange because I played mostly in French.
Yeah.
It felt more comfortable. I don't know if it sounds natural.
No,
it does.
It felt more like acting in English than in French. Very strange.
I think that the film Eden is sort of one of these films that's coming out at the moment that is very much rooted in music, and you have history in film and in music. And do you think that the American film Whiplash won a lot of Oscars this year, and do you think films about music mm-hmm. are seeing a resurgence, and there could be coming a really major thing in the near future?
That's interesting. I think very, very delicate question. I think, how can I answer that? I think it could be, you know, in a way that music stories are, I feel, let's say, if I talk from the point of view of my generation, mm-hmm. I feel that my generation communicates very much with music. And I don't know if it's because I'm leaving my generation more deeply than other generations, with my generation, but like just electro parties, for instance, it's just a guy putting music through a DJ booth. Mm. But like, I don't know how many thousands of people can be able to communicate with just one song, mm. you know? And I feel that you can take something from that and put it into movies. And the other thing, which I believe, is there will be more stories about normal people. You know, we have been so much talking about stories and also biopics and stuff like that, mm. about people who had incredible lives, and we have been talking about much more about extraordinary lives than normal lives.
Yeah.
And music is a good background to talk about normal stories. Even Whiplash, which is more, I would not say American, but you know, which is more, the script is more, with the ups and, not ups and downs, but with the surprises, and his life is more extraordinary than Eden.
Mm.
There is something about the normal guy, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
talks about the guy who is passionate.
Yeah,
and that the basis line is this.
Yeah, you said there about Whiplash being a very American film, and there's a lot of stuff in Eden which is influenced quite a bit by American cinema. I mean, Greta Gerwig is in the film, who is a major star of American independent films. And do you have an interest in American independent films? Do you have any hopes of going and acting there?
Yeah, exactly. You spotted the right thing. I mean, I think it's there is a very vivid cinema in America right now.
Mm.
Maybe it's just because, you know, the grass is greener elsewhere. But I believe, like for instance, the whole crew of Borderline films, you know, like Shandor King, which is English actually, but you know, all this group around Paddy Corbet, I think they're they have something very independent and very fresh, and still very rooted to traditional cinema. You know, they want to shoot their film in films, they want to, but there is really something happening. And there, but also in Noah's film, I mean, a lot of films that I admire are American indie films.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
In terms of your generation and your generation's relationship with music and dance music, how do you think that differs from what somebody of Sven's generation and the character Paul's generation experienced in the 90s, in terms of how technology has made it different experience to create and to consume this sort of music?
I think my generation is much more anxious.
Mm.
I think when what I say mostly about the 90s is there is a generation between Berlin Wall and the Twin Towers.
Yeah.
So they lived like 12 years of very deep innocence.
Yeah.
Very deep, they were very hedonist. And so they were able to leave everything in a very carpe diem way, you know. Enjoy the day, seize the day, and stuff like that. Which is very different from my generation. My generation is angst. And also the drugs people take. In the 90s, they took ecstasy, which is really reflects this kind of spirit. In our days, we're taking more with MDMA and stuff like that. And I think it's really it's interesting on what it says about generation and what how people consume this music, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's very clear. No, but it is a gap.
Yeah, definitely. Would you be, you know, the music that's featured in the film is this, you know, this music which sort of set the rules for dance music in the 90s. But in terms of how that sort of music has evolved to the present day, where do you think dance music can go further, can evolve in terms of your relationship with us, even?
I have a friend who thinks it's just going to become noise.
Yeah.
He's a very big, you know, there's a music called drone music,
mm-hmm.
and drone music is without beats. Mm. It's just a buzz, basically. It looks like a buzz. Yeah. And here, it's just like, wom, wom. And so he's a really hardcore believer that electric music is going to go this way, just into a sort of noise, like I would say noise music. I think I'm kind of, I mean, that's an argument I'm deploying against him. I think it's going to go back to very live music, instruments. I think we're going to go back to something more human, more live.
Hmm. Okay.
But that's my belief.
Okay, thank you. We're out of time now, but thanks for talking to us. And
congratulations
on the film.
Thank you very much, guys.
Congrats on the film. Thanks. It's really great. Okay.
So thanks again to Felix for talking to us, and just a reminder that Eden is in cinemas in the UK and Ireland today.
Yes, it is. Go check it
out. So there's been some crazy news this week. This website called AshleyMadison.com.
I know.
Which you know, I've heard of a few times throughout my life and just sort of scoffed at its existence. It's basically a dating website for people who wish to have extramarital affairs. You know, there's a market for that, clearly.
I'm signing up as we speak.
Yeah. It was, yeah, I'm sure, yeah, your wife will be disgusted with you, Michael.
Yeah, she can't find out about this.
Okay. We'll just hope our millions of listeners don't tell her. So, Ashley Madison got hacked. I'm not entirely sure who hacked it, but they seem to be a group who disagree with its the ethics of the website, which, you know, you can't really argue with that. And they hacked it. They now obtain the names and information of all of its users, including thousands of users here in Ireland and in Galway.
Wow.
The numbers were pretty staggering. I think there was something like 2,000 users of this website just here in Galway alone, which is mad. But anyway, so this is a situation where these people who, you know, they've done nothing illegal, but they've done things which are, you know, somewhat unethical and that they clearly would not want their partners to find out about, and they are at serious risk of their information being released online. Now, I would argue that this is in many ways the fault of the company for not having better security on their servers.
Well, to a certain extent, I mean, there's only so far you can go. If you get hacked by a large group of computers, if you get like attacked by this huge number of like a botnet, for example, there is very little you can do, you know, to defend yourself from it. I guess obviously it is their fault. I mean, they're going to have to try and come up with alternatives to make sure that the information is more secure. Being honest, if this was any other company, I'd be more concerned.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Ashley Madison, their motto is life is short, have an affair. I mean, this is crazy. They're claiming over 37 million anonymous members. This is crazy. Like, I mean, it's... If it was, as I said, if it was any other service, I'd probably care, but I really couldn't care about this.
I know. It's hardly an interesting story, but really it's just, if these people's information is released, well, there's going to be, great business for divorce lawyers.
Yeah, definitely.
A lot of broken families. It has its good and bad sides. But think of all the children of these couples who are now going to be left with, broken home. I don't know.
Well, I mean, there is something to be taken out of this, and that is that, and it's something that I always keep in mind, is that anything that you put up on the internet, that you do on the internet, could potentially have consequences.
And if you sign up for a website that where you are like actively cheating on your spouse, it's probably best not to use your real address and email address.
Yeah.
Maybe. Just a thought. I don't know, for future reference.
I mean, they even say don't do that on Facebook, so.
Yeah. That's probably a good idea too.
Yeah. But even with email, like Gmail, they can search through all your emails. I mean, they use personal stuff sent in emails to target ads towards you.
Yeah, they do.
And a lot of people aren't aware of that, and they might have like confidential conversations about maybe business or something like that on their email. And I mean, Google are actively it's most of the time it's a bot, obviously, that searches through all your emails, looks for relevant content, and they will direct advertising accordingly. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
It's kind of scary stuff.
Moving on. Michael?
Yeah.
How do you feel about seagulls?
I don't particularly like seagulls.
You don't like seagulls? Well, you're not alone, because a lot of people here in Ireland and in the UK, seagulls are reportedly attacking and killing sheep in Ireland, in Kerry. And in one dramatic attack, a motorcyclist on the road was swooped on in an attack. He compared to a Second World War dive bomb, so expertly was the attack executed, with the gull protecting his wings.
Really?
So these seagulls are being considered a menace to society. Some people in the government have been calling for the culling of seagulls. Now, there are two levels to this. Firstly, there are people complaining about the seagulls who live by the sea, and I would argue to that these seagulls were here first. It's their natural habitat. But when the seagulls are coming to farms and coming inland, I mean, there's definitely something kind of unnatural about it.
Yeah, I mean, when you go out in the sea, you're I would go out fishing the odd time. I mean, the seagulls, there's just so many of them. They won't come near you. I mean, these attacks on people. How many reported attacks have there been?
I don't know. There's one example given here. A man called Vincent Appleby, a large gull nearly knocked him off his vehicle. This is in the Irish Times today.
Wow. Yeah. I don't know.
You have a strong opinion, Michael. You have to have a strong opinion about the seagulls.
No. I really don't. I think they're fine. There's a lot of them around, but as long as you don't annoy them, they'll stay away from you, I'm pretty sure. I mean, that was obviously an extreme case.
I think seagulls killing sheep is not something that's supposed to happen, but I don't...
I'm pretty sure that can't happen.
I don't know. Tell me a bit about VidCon.
Well, I mean, I don't know if there's much to say, but... VidCon is an annual conference that's done every year. It started yesterday, so the 23rd of July, and it goes through to the 25th of July. Basically, it's held in Anaheim, California, every year, and it's just a conference for online video creators to come together. Maybe collaborate on some projects, talk about online video. Most of the people who would be coming would be YouTubers, maybe some video podcast networks. So any online video content creators, they basically come there. I mean, some interesting stuff comes from the conference. It's more just a place for video makers to come together and basically talk about video and online video and the future of it. So, I mean, they have roundtables, they have discussions, they have speakers of people in the online industry.
I'll tell you, just as you're talking now, I've seen John Green, author and YouTuber, has just posted on his social media channels about to go on the main stage at VidCon.
Yeah, he's doing the opening keynote for the conference, and he'll obviously be one of many speakers to be speaking throughout few days.
People like him who have sort of gone from a YouTube fame to being, you know, a very, very successful person in the mainstream entertainment industry are kind of he would be a great figurehead of sort of ideal success for people who make videos like that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's so strange now how the way that we consume video has changed. I mean, I don't think there was... I think YouTube cannot be compared to anything. Mm. You know, there was never anything... You know, you look at Netflix and you're like, well, TV, we always had TV, and now TV is just coming online. It's just a different way for us to experience TV. But for I mean, the kind of content that's created on YouTube is something that we never consumed before. Yeah. And it's a really, really interesting. I don't think TV has a future on YouTube or anything, but it's a really interesting kind of a short form kind of content that has kind of made its way. Loads of gaming.
Yeah.
Loads of gaming, loads of technology kind of stuff. Do you watch any? Are you subscribed to any gamers on YouTube or anything?
No, my interest in gaming is minimal to non-existent. Do you?
No, I don't. I mean, I probably used to at one stage.
Good talk.
but I mean, what do you use YouTube for? I'd be just interested.
I mean, for myself, I use it just really, it's convenient for storage of videos. And also, I think the player interface for watching videos is really, really excellent. And I haven't seen anything that I enjoy as much. I think that it's really easy to use. I think it works very smoothly on multiple devices. I think logging in and accessing your sort of personalized content is very, very convenient. And it's a far more simple and easy experience than a lot of other video playing, you know, software and such.
Yeah, definitely. And something to keep in mind is the fact that YouTube is the second largest search engine in the world.
Mm.
So it's Google is number one. And then for searching, just for anything, the second is for YouTube. So people will go to YouTube and they'll just go and search for something. So if they want to like find out about something, or if they want to look up how to do something or how to play a musical instrument or anything, YouTube is kind of the place to go.
Yeah.
And it's becoming huge, obviously, with VidCon.
It is taking over the world.
It's taking over the world.
It's scary stuff. It's a monopoly.
It's, yeah. You have to be very, very... watch out for that YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean...
You when you're not paying attention.
Yeah, but, like, even... I mean, video creators don't like YouTube as a whole, either. Because it's kind of... It's monopolized. So YouTube have complete control over the market now. They could do whatever they want.
Google, you know? in so many areas, have that at the moment, really, with maps and with...
Taking over the world.
They are taking over the world.
I mean, yeah, like, so a lot of YouTubers are they start their own sites. So if they ever need to go off, you know, move away from YouTube, they can redirect their subscribers to their own sites. But that's really costly.
Yeah,
you know, there's no really good solution to YouTube out there.
Uh-huh. Anyway, moving on now. We talked a bit last week. Well, we played a clip last week of Sarah Palin. trying to put her own spin on a Dr. Seuss classic.
Yeah.
And this week there was some exciting Dr. Seuss news. Michael, tell us about this Dr. Seuss news.
There was some really exciting Dr. Seuss news, because everybody should know at this stage that I'm a huge Dr. Seuss fan.
You're the biggest Dr. Seuss fan.
So, Dr. Seuss died in 1991, and pretty much all of his personal items were kind of donated to a museum. But I think his widow was quite recently searching through his stuff, and she found the manuscript to a story that had not been published, that had not been found. It was just kind of, it just had disappeared. Obviously, maybe he didn't think it was, for whatever reason, he didn't want to publish it. And so they found it, and they're publishing it now. Has it come out yet?
It is being released, I believe, next Tuesday.
Very exciting.
Very exciting. Now, I mean, I would be wary after the disaster we had last week where Ghost Set of Watchmen was released and, you know, it was not up to the standard we would have hoped. I'd be worried that this book might reveal one of the classic Dr. Seuss characters to be a member of the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, he has the several characters in this from his classics, the brother and sister from One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish. I mean, one of these kids could quite easily be a serious racist.
Yeah.
I think we should be worried about this.
Yeah, I mean, there was an obvious reason that it wasn't published in the first place.
I mean, who knows what Dr. Seuss, I'm sure, just like Harper Lee, was not himself a racist, but who knows what he could have done to our beloved characters.
Yeah. So the name of the book is What Pet Should I Get?
Well, what pet should you get, Michael?
Well, that's the question that's going to be answered in the book. I mean, originally, that's not what it was called.
So who came up with this name?
So that was something that was done by the publishing company. The original name, it was originally just a manuscript labeled The Pet Shop. The manuscript was not fully complete. It wasn't ready for publication. So they took what was there, the manuscript, they modified it slightly. They had his last art director, a woman by the name of Kathy Goldsmith, to kind of select the colors that were going to be used on the book, in the book, to choose all of the kind of the styles and illustrations and the way that the book was going to be kind of laid out and stuff. So they did a little bit of modification too, because the manuscript was quite rough, but it's 95% his work, I would say.
99%.
99% his work, yeah. So I'm going to get it.
As am I.
I could be disappointed. But the fact that they're publishing it must mean that it's decent enough.
Michael, do you use emojis?
I don't really. It's a tough one. I use them sometimes. That's my answer. But I mostly just use the smiley face.
Yeah. Oh, same as me. I try not to use them because I think it, I don't know, makes me seem illiterate. I use them sparsely and with great caution. But there was a big emoji news this week, if you can actually believe that emoji news is a real thing that exists.
Oh, yeah.
And that is that there is an emoji movie finally greenlit.
Oh, thank God. It's finally come. I've been waiting for this for so long.
Oh, I had my fist clenched just waiting for that emoji movie to be announced. There was a big bidding war for the rights to make the emoji movie. Sony Pictures Animation won in a seven-figure deal.
Oh, wow.
For an animated movie centering on the emoji. The project will be co-written by Eric Siegel and Anthony Leondis. Leondis will direct the film. He pitched to three studios with storyboards. And there are no rights to the emoji. So it was really just this one guy and his his storyboards and his concept that the seven figure deal was for, because they didn't actually have to buy the rights. So technically, they could just as easily make a different Emoji movie, and we could have competing Emoji movies.
Oh my god, this could be the beginning of the end.
I mean, what is there to live for anymore when there's an Emoji movie? More than one, quite likely.
And what was the thinking behind this?
I mean, emojis. People like emojis. Children like emojis. I mean, there was a Moshi Monsters movie 2 years ago, and an Angry Birds movie is released next 4th of July weekend next year.
Yeah.
And I guess there are children and young people who enjoy these films. Well, they definitely won't enjoy the films, but they enjoy these products, these concepts, and they will force their parents to spend a lot of money taking them to see the film, which is probably going to be about 55 minutes long. The child will, you know, demand popcorn and drinks, and the parents' wallet will be completely empty by the time they leave the cinema.
Probably true.
Yeah, I'm not too excited about this Emoji movie. I'm gonna from this moment on, I'm just going to ignore it and hope that it goes away.
Yeah.
We can only dream.
Yeah. So, Lucy, I think we should have a little bit of a discussion. And the discussion that I want to have today is about internet censorship. And it's something that we're seeing more and more. I know you have an opinion on this, that you're just, that's waiting, it's inside you, it's waiting to come out.
My opinion doesn't matter.
Yeah. That's what he says every single time before, you know, if he's trying to bottle it in, you know, he says my opinion doesn't matter. Trying to please everybody, exactly. So internet censorship, an extremely controversial topic in the media at the moment. You know, you have net neutrality, which is a huge kind of a battle going on in many countries in the legal systems at the moment. And net neutrality is essentially where service providers of internet can filter what internet that you get. So you could have a censored version of the internet, so you don't get everything that's on the internet, and you may have to pay more. That's one thing. You may have to pay more to see more of the internet. That's a possibility. Mm-hmm. And
it wouldn't also that certain sites and companies would have to pay so that their websites would load faster for customers.
Yes, this is just, you know, exactly. There's a lot of different things that might come in here, all driven by money. By service providers who want to take control of the way that we experience internet, and essentially just to make more money. So it's crazy.
It really is. But I mean, there was some activity around this in the US last year, and I know that the people who wanted net new, you know, it didn't work out for them really, and the internet was sort of allowed to remain as it was. But what's happening here in Ireland right now is there is a legal debate of sorts over sort of censoring and legal, I guess, the ramifications for online bullying and threats of violence. Senator Lorraine Higgins has been making a big argument that the internet should be a safer place for people, and they shouldn't be the victims of bullying or of threats, and she thinks this should be dealt with in the law and in the judicial system. And she's been receiving death threats personally, which are really awful. But it begs the question, you know, does the internet need to be completely void of legal and governmental interference in order to be a free space, the free space that we think it is?
Well, I don't think it is now.
Mm.
I mean, censorship exists right now, and it's already, we already see it in effect with the EU law that recently came in that basically allows anybody to request a web page to be removed from a search engine.
Mm.
If the web page, you know, is obviously relevant to them. So if it's maybe a slanderous web page or story that may affect that person, they have the right to request it to be taken down by a search engine. And this is already being implemented by Google. So you can go ahead now and fill out a form to take down a web page. So for us in Europe, we are essentially, if you're using Google, you're seeing a filtered or a censored version of the search results.
Mm.
Because not all of them may come up. Now, if you go outside of Europe, you get an uncensored version. But this is, so government intervention has already, is already in effect. In the EU, they have this law that came in, extremely controversial topic. A lot of people were complaining about it, especially people from the US. They really didn't want to see this being implemented in the US. They thought it was terrible. I don't think it is though. I mean, it's a difficult thing, but I think ultimately, if it prevents, if it makes the internet a safer place, if it makes the internet a better place, I think it's very, it's a good thing. It's beneficial. There was a lot of, I mean, a lot of people hated on the way that it was being implemented, particularly by Google. But I think Google have perfected it now so that it's only if the person has a genuine reason for taking that web page down that it gets accepted. It's not like anybody can just do it. It's a difficult process to do. So I, you know, I think cyberbullying is an issue.
Yeah.
And absolutely. And if we can do anything to prevent it, I think we should try it. But censorship for the sake of making money is absolutely ridiculous and absurd.
And once you allow censorship of something that is, you know, wholly publicly accessible and sort of supposed to be a free space, then there is just so much possibility for corruption.
Yeah.
And for people who are trying, people in a minority, people who are trying to in a country where there is a dictatorship or whatever, and people are trying to generate knowledge about the truth on the internet as a free space. Because if the mainstream media is corrupted, then once the internet, once Google and companies like that are allowing the government to interfere, be it the you know, Irish government or government in another country where there are stricter regulations, then you have the possibility of this certain information being pushed to the bottom of the pile, and the information that, you know, the people with the money want you to know comes up to the top.
Yeah, and that's where law comes in. That's where law protects us from government abusing power over search engines, for example, or any company that has a lot of influence over the internet. And, you know, so obviously this European law doesn't allow governments to dictate what web pages are allowed on the internet and what web pages aren't. That would be absolutely, that would be terrible. There have been governments who have tried to do that, especially where there is a rebellion. And those companies have simply just pulled out of those countries. That's the only real thing that they can do. It's a difficult thing. I mean, what's your take on it?
I don't know. I mean, I think there's obviously there's a lot of dangerous content on the internet, as it's been proven that it can harm children who are just exposed to all sorts of stuff, and also it can damage people's careers, and obviously bullying is a huge issue, slander. These are things, I mean, I'm not talking about slander against, you know, big business. Yeah. This is slander against individuals and just very kind of low-level forms, which can really damage a person's life and damage them emotionally. But, and you know, the companies are obviously trying their best not to be sucked into a system where governments are dictating what they can do. And even in terms of the taxes they pay, there are ways in which that could begin to happen. And especially when these technology companies are setting up shop in all over the world.
Yeah.
Companies that were founded and are based in the US are coming here, and they're coming to Europe. And I don't know.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can see most recently Reddit has been a huge trending topic. Mm-hmm. With a new CEO came in at Reddit, and she wanted to just remove some of the, I think she removed 5 of the most offensive Reddit threads.
Yeah. I mean, there was Reddit one called fat people shaming or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just horrible stuff. And there's been quite a lot of uproar from Reddit users. Not because of the thread being taken down, but the fact that they're taking threads down.
Well, the argument is, should people, if they wish, be allowed to use a free space like the internet to mock fat people? Should they be allowed to, if they want to?
Yeah.
I mean, it depends if you're, you know, going out finding pictures of people who you consider to be overweight, posting them and saying, this person is fat, haha, and that person, you know, finds this and is deeply, deeply offended by it. Or if one is just, you know, having a cruel and probably slightly sadistic sense of humor, but nonetheless is really just having fun, as they would put it. You know, should the internet, I mean, Reddit is one website. I mean, these people can set up their own sites. They can use the dark net or whatever that thing. I mean, obviously not for something like making fun of the obese. You do that for much more, you know, criminal activity. Yeah. But, I mean, this is considered to be a free space available to all. And when certain companies are deciding what is and isn't acceptable to be discussed and talked about on this, in this space, you know, that's the question.
Yeah, and a lot of people saw Reddit as that kind of free space.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely one of the freest spaces in the mainstream side of the internet.
But Reddit became very commercial, and you know, they have investors on, and they want to see a return. They want to see profit. That's what they're driven by, and so the new CEO has been put under a lot of pressure to clean up Reddit and to make it a profitable company and a viable business. Mm. And the only way to do that is by removing those ridiculously absurd, offensive threads. And I think it might be over for Reddit, because that's what everybody uses Reddit for.
Yeah.
You know, that's like the great thing about Reddit is you can post whatever the hell you want on it.
Yeah.
Internet censorship is a very, now there's an interesting thing you brought up about children and protecting them. Well, there is actually a great solution that I really believe in. And this company was actually OpenDNS, were recently bought by Google, I believe. I'm pretty sure. I've used OpenDNS for a long time as for the DNS servers. Now, I don't know if you're aware of what a DNS server is, Lucian.
Not really.
Okay, it's really, really simple. If you look at the internet, it's made up of basically a bunch of computers that are interconnected, right?
Mm-hmm.
Each one of those computers has an IP address, so it's a random number. Well, what a DNS does is it's what assigns a human-friendly name to computer, to IP addresses. So, for example, Google.com. Google.com is
99pshow.com.
99pshow.com, the website for this podcast. You go there, well, that URL is associated with an IP address, and that is done through DNS. So that's what DNS does. It's a way for your computer to associate human-friendly names with IP addresses. Very simple. Every computer needs it. Every computer has it to be able to go to google.com or 99pshow.com or any great website. And Google have their own DNS services, their own DNS IP addresses, but OpenDNS were pretty much the first people to do this. So I think it's Cisco, I believe, who are intending to acquire OpenDNS. But OpenDNS provides some great services, and one of the great services that they provide is the ability to be able to remove certain websites and block certain websites.
Yeah.
So you can set up your DNS on your router to block, for example, pornography.
Yeah.
So that if you have children in the house or whatever, and you do not want your children to see those websites, you can just very, very simply filter them out. And that's a really, really great solution. And that's a form of censorship that can be controlled, but you can control it yourself. And it's a very personal way of doing it. I think that's a very effective way.
Yeah. That's self-censorship in a way.
Yeah, absolutely is.
It's not, yeah.
That's a great way of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Censorship, internet stuff, I'm sure we'll get back to it very soon in future episodes. Michael, do you have a hot new track for us this week?
Well, I do. I love music, as you know. And so every week I have a hot new track. Last week I recommended the Alabama Shakes to listen to their new album. This week I'm going to recommend something. It's not for everybody. I don't know if you're aware of Laura Marling.
I am. Is she I listened to one of her albums that came out.
Yeah.
Wow, must have been 6 or 7 years ago now.
Yeah, she has a new album out, released the 17th of July. It's called Short Movie.
Mm-hmm.
She has a very distinctive style. I would say she's kind of... She doesn't really... She's not a singer. She's a storyteller. So her singing style is not... It's not singing per se, it's poetry more. So she doesn't really, for a lot of her songs, she doesn't have a melody. But I'm going to recommend the first track on her album. It's called Warrior. It's not, it's a very different album to her previous albums, because she started playing electric guitar in this. Previously, she's very well known as an acoustic guitarist. Warrior is an extremely well produced song. I thoroughly enjoyed the kind of the different layers to the song. So I'll play it now for you.
He needs to is a battle he don't want to face alone. I bolt upwards and shake him off my back. He falls to his knees onto a bloody track. Well, I can't be your horse anymore. You're not the warrior I've been looking for.
So that's Warrior. That's my recommendation for my hot new track of the
very
week.
Nice.
It's a very different song, but yeah.
Yeah, the album of hers that I listened to was I Speak Because I Can in 2010. Yeah. I listened to that like the day it came out, and I don't think I've listened to a single track of her since. But that is not a testament to the quality of her music, because she is a very interesting and a very talented artist.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to listen to the album again. I only listened to it once. It's not like an album that I'm going to keep coming back to. But I mean, I enjoyed it when I was listening to it. It wasn't. Yeah. It was definitely quality music. Yep, so that's my hot new track.
Tiny bit of entertainment news here, and that is related to Jurassic World. We have double back-to-back Jurassic World news. First part of the news is that yesterday, Jurassic World officially became the third highest-grossing film in the history of film.
What?
Number three.
Okay, so number one is...
Avatar.
Number two...
Titanic.
And number three is Jurassic World.
Yeah. Now, Furious 7 got really close. We all thought it was going to hit number 3 last month, but it stayed at number 4. It just cut it short. And now another Universal film, and Furious 7 now was the first ever Universal film to hit $1 billion. Not only did Furious 7 hit $1 billion, but just 2 months later, Jurassic World also hit $1 billion, and Minions is also set to hit $1 billion. Universal are having a crazy year.
Wow.
But yeah, Jurassic World has done far better business than I predicted or the many has predicted. I mean, Furious 7 had a lot going for it. It had Paul Walker's death, which drew a lot of interest to the film.
Yeah.
It had a very international setting. It had a lot of appeal in the Asian market, both because of its cast and its location and its director. And Furious 7 just seemed like it was a recipe for a sort of 2015 hit film. Jurassic World, however, other than, you know, a nostalgia for the original Jurassic Park and Chris Pratt, it didn't have a lot of appealing factors to the major demographic, as far as I could see. But clearly, I was incredibly wrong, because it is now the number three film of all time with $1.52 billion. And breaking news, in the past half hour, we have gotten confirmation from Universal that Jurassic World sequel on the way.
Of course it is.
June 22nd, 2018.
There you
go. Chris Pratt and Bryce Dallas Howard will return, and Colin Trevorrow, the director of Jurassic World, will not direct, but he will write the script.
Well, there you go. I haven't seen Jurassic World.
And that is very, very perfectly okay.
Is it acceptable in society to not have seen the third highest?
If you die, I would say that seeing the only reason to see Jurassic World is that it is the third highest. Frankly, there is no other real reason to bother watching it.
And how does where does the Avengers come in on this?
The Avengers was number three until yesterday.
Yeah. Okay.
So that the top 10 highest grossing films list is now number 1, Avatar, number 2, Titanic, 3, Jurassic World, number 4 is The Avengers, then Furious 7,
right.
Avengers Age of Ultron, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2,
wow.
Frozen, Iron Man 3, and Transformers Dark of the Moon. And this is the crazy statistic. Of the top 6 films of all time, 3 were released between April 2015 and June 2015. Half of the top 6 films released within 2 months of each other this year. Crazy.
I think I've seen all the films except for Jurassic World.
Have you seen Transformers Dark of the Moon?
I have.
And Frozen?
Frozen I haven't seen.
Oh,
so I haven't seen Frozen, Jurassic World, and I haven't watched... I basically haven't watched Titanic. I was too young to remember it.
Yeah, well, Titanic, none of these... I can tell you, of the films in the top 10, if you had, you know, a year to live, the only one worth watching would be Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. I don't think any of these other films are really worth seeing, really.
Yeah, definitely.
Avatar has its moments.
Fast and Furious. Come on.
The first Avengers and Harry Potter are, you know, decent films. The rest are not so much. It's time now for Nicolas Cage film of the week.
Oh my god, I'm looking forward. This is like my favorite part of the show.
Whose isn't it? Featuring Bill Murray as the president.
Nicolas Cage film of the week.
So this week's Nicolas Cage film of the week is Adaptation. Now this is an actual classic. Our last 2 weeks we've, you know, Melbourne Sound, we were effing around. But this week we have a proper, legit, classic film. I will put a link here for you, Michael, so you can learn a bit about the film that is Adaptation. There we go.
Yeah.
IMDb link. So Adaptation is written and directed by Spike Jonze, directed by Spike Jonze, who directed films like Her, Being John Malkovich, and it's written by Charlie Kaufman, and Charlie Kaufman is a very, very cool guy. He wrote Being John Malkovich, which is terrific. He wrote Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Schenectady, New York. And basically, Adaptation is it stars Nicolas Cage as Charlie Kaufman, the screenwriter of the film.
Yeah.
And in the film, Charlie Kaufman is trying to write a film with Meryl Streep in it. So he's writing a film in Adaptation. But while he's writing the film Adaptation, he decides to make a film about writing the film in Adaptation. So he decides to make Adaptation. So he has to hire a director, he has to hire an actor to play himself. He hires Nicolas Cage to play himself, even though Nicolas Cage is the only... Charlie Kaufman isn't in Adaptation, but Nicolas Cage plays Charlie Kaufman, playing a man, you know, who wants to hire Nicolas Cage. It is the most meta film ever made. It's up there. If you enjoy Community, if you enjoy the work of Mohsen Makhmalbaf, then this is the film for you. It is crazy. It'll mess with your head with its just sheer self-reflexivity. And it's got great performances from Nicolas Cage, Meryl Streep, and Chris Cooper. Chris Cooper won an Academy Award for this film. And frankly, Nicolas Cage should have too. He's really terrific. It's one of his best ever dramatic performances. And it's really funny, and it is just a fantastic film. It's called Adaptation, colon, that is... Adaptation, period. There is a full stop in the name. And it is from 2002, and I recommend that you... I demand that you go and watch it and send us your reviews.
Definitely. I'm going to watch it.
And Michael, have we got any reviews in of last week's Nicolas Cage film of the week, which was The Death of Superman Lives? Do we have any reviews of that?
We have not.
Oh, dear. Our listeners have let us down once again.
I know. We love you, listeners.
We do. The most exciting part of the show has arrived. Low Stakes Cereal. We have an update on Salt Hill bathroom closures. This is major, major, exciting, breaking news update. So we discussed previously on the show that the public toilets in Salt Hill, Galway were being closed for no apparent reason. There was Garda tape around them. We now have actual, legitimate, confirmed information about this. I will now read the article very, very fast. It's costing Galway City Council a pretty penny for visitors in Salt Hill to spend a penny at the temporary toilets. A local councillor claims it is costing €15,000 for the next 3 months to service the four portaloos that have been put in place along the promenade. The temporary toilets have been rented from a private operator with two placed in different places. They were hired after the permanent council toilets were damaged by fire in a suspected arson incident last November, still under investigation by Gardaí.
That is
crazy. There was an arson attack on these toilets, Michael.
They tried to put them up on fire.
It's insane. But it means one thing. It means that no one, from the sound of it, actually died, and there was no death, as we suspected. Yeah. So it's not as tragic.
Whoever's
responsible for this is a terrible person.
I mean,
why would you ever set fire to a public toilet? What did the public toilet do to you?
People need to use these toilets.
Absolutely, they do.
It's costing €15,000 for the county council.
We're still in a recession. We can't be spending money on things like that.
Yeah.
Crazy. So that's really all this week's update on the toilets. But I think there's a new issue that I'd like to mention briefly, which is Japanese knotweed. This is a Japanese knotweed that's taking over the country. I found an article, and then it linked me to a Facebook group called the Japanese Knotweed Survey and Awareness Project. This is a group of Irish people, currently has 30 members, who are trying to combat the Japanese knotweed outbreak. They have if you go on to their, are you on this group, Michael? Are you looking at it?
No, you're going to have to explain this to me.
Okay, well, scroll down, because there's a picture of Michael Stack, our solicitor, and a picture of Evert van Veenendaal. These are two men who are working on the Japanese knotweed project. And They're interesting guys. Just click on that link there just posted. You'll see if you scroll down a bit. So Japanese knotweed is this weed, and it is really dangerous, apparently. It is an invasive herbaceous perennial and one of the most invasive species in Ireland to date. So people are trying to get this dealt with and trying to get it removed. Apparently it is very dangerous. I don't know in what ways, and frankly I don't care to find out, but just be aware, people, if you hear of Japanese knotweed in your locale, you really you should probably lock all the doors.
you have to burn your entire garden.
Yeah. Yes, you do. But not in the same way that the people burnt down those public toilets.
Oh, no. This is a different kind of... This is a professional way. This is like what the farmers in Connemara...
Don't start a crazy bushfire, because we don't want one of those.
Oh, no. Everybody knows that the Connemara farmers are extremely professional when it comes to burning the gorse.
So that's really all we have time for.
All we have time for?
The 99% is a co-production of Kara Digital and BuzzHub Entertainment. Michael, tell me a bit about BuzzHub Entertainment. They sound great. They sound so cool.
BuzzHub is like the greatest website on earth if you want to find out about all your latest TV show news, movie news.
Jurassic World news.
Jurassic World, if you want to find out about all
and
about Jurassic World.
This week, BuzzHub has a very nice 2,500-word interview with Sven Hanselöv and Felix de Givry. Exclusive extended write-up of the interviews. Cool. And it is distributor-approved.
Very cool.
So look that up, and it's very, very nice.
And the up-and-coming Pixar movie, of course.
Of course, Inside Out is out tomorrow. It's released today.
Today, sorry. My apologies.
Today. It's released today, Friday.
I think I might go see that.
Along with Eden. So we recommend you go see them both. But equally, Eden and Inside Out, see them both.
Yeah.
They're both great.
Yeah.
And Carb Digital is a fantastic website. You can visit carbdigital.com and get your websites designed and hosted and all sorts of stuff. They do a fantastic job. They've got some top-level professional clients who would recommend them to their last dying breath. That's how great they are. I love Carb Digital. I don't personally avail of their services simply because they're just...
Oh, but you've already availed of their services.
Actually, because 99pshow.com is a great sample of their fantastic work and abilities. So check out our website, 99pshow.com, to see an example.
Full disclosure, that is my business.
BuzzHub Entertainment is my, quote, business.
Yes.
More of a hobby, but, you know,
absolutely.
Things expand. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, you can subscribe on Stitcher, or on any podcasting app you may wish to subscribe on. Just visit our site and get all the links there. We are on facebook.com/99pshow, twitter.com/99pshow, instagram.com/99pshow. I am Revolutionary, Michael is McAndrew Tweets, and next week we will have another terrific episode with special guest Niall O'Toole, a local politician here in Galway, who will be talking to us about the process of running an election campaign, his involvement in the hugely successful marriage equality campaign, which was passed, Go Equality, and basically about the state of politics in general in Ireland. Fascinating interview. You won't want to miss it, will you, Michael?
No.
Okay. And also next week, you will probably get to hear less of me talking loudly and rapidly and talking over people, and more of Michael talking in a slower, more calm way, because we will have more time to do the show.
We will.
Hopefully.
Okay, we'll see you next week. Thank you for listening.
Adios, amigos.